Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it's been a tumultuous few weeks in Washington as the Senate bill to replace the Affordable Care Act has dominated the health policy discussion.
Well, Mark, watching these events unfold at times was a little like watching a spy thriller. What was actually in the bill? Would there be enough votes to carry the bill? And who would be the villain in the piece? Who are the likely victims? And who would succumb to constituent pressures and reject a bill that the CBO predicted would lead to millions of Americans ending up without coverage? And then, with all that suspense, in the 11th hour, key Republican Senator John McCain had an unexpected medical crisis, which threw a vote delay into the mix.
Moderates like Susan Collins of Maine were already on record as opposed to the bill.
Well, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell immediately launched another quest for a straight-up repeal of the bill, and a handful of Republican senators quickly announced they would not support it.
But for the time being, it remains the law of the land, and the discussion is far from over. The cost of health care is still out of control, and health outcomes are not what they should be, Margaret.
And that brings us to our guest today. Dr. Mark Fendrick is the co-founder of the concept of value-based insurance design. It's a newer way of looking at how we design insurance to better utilize resources with a focus on spending more for coverage that yields the highest value and the best outcomes. It's an interesting concept, and it's gaining traction, Mark.
Lori Robertson also stops by. She's the managing editor of factcheck.org. She's always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we'd love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Mark Fendrick in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. John McCain and the 11th hour. There have been more twists and turns on Capitol Hill regarding health policy than the boomerang roller coaster at Six Flags, when it was learned veteran Republican Senator John McCain had been diagnosed with an aggressive form of brain cancer. Senate leadership delayed the vote on repeal and replace of Obamacare that promised to be extremely close. After surgery, Senator McCain found his way back to Washington to cast the pivotal vote on a procedural measure, which technically was only aimed at resuming discussion of the Senate bill. Now the matter has been reopened for debate and will continue to undergo many iterations in coming days. Meanwhile, the Trump administration has slashed money in the budget that had been earmarked for teen pregnancy prevention programs. The Trump administration has said there's no evidence these programs are effective. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology point to the dramatic drop in teen pregnancy rates in recent years as evidence programs like these are working very well. Rachel Fay of the National Campaign to Prevent Teen and Unplanned Pregnancy says the teen birth rate has fallen about 40% nationally since the program went into effect in 2010. Chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, has long been known to be associated with exposure to head trauma. Survivors of NFL players who watched their loved ones succumb to the degenerative brain disease have been battling the football franchise for some time. Now a new report confirms some alarming statistics. 110 of the 111 brains of former NFL players donated for research all showed signs of the degenerative brain disorder. And the study concludes that while the NFL risk seems to be highest for this disorder, all brain trauma has some statistical link. The study, conducted by Boston University's CTE Center, confirms repeated head trauma can lead to higher levels of tau plaques in the brain. And it wasn't until 2016 that the NFL finally agreed to acknowledge the connection. Efforts to reduce head trauma in youth football and other contact sports are starting to take hold across the country. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mark Fendrick, co-founder and director of the University of Michigan Center for Value-Based Insurance Design. Dr. Fendrick is a practicing general internist and a professor in the Department of Internal Medicine, as well as the Department of Health Management and Policy at the University of Michigan. Dr. Fendrick co-created the concept of value-based insurance design and is founding partner of VBID Health. He's co-editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Managed Care and was named by Health Leaders Media as one of the 20 people who will make healthcare better. He earned his BA in economics and chemistry from the University of Pennsylvania and his MD from Harvard School of Medicine. Dr. Fendrick, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great. Mark, you obviously are keeping track with what's happening in Washington to replace the Affordable Care Act. And the bill created by the GOP-controlled Senate had a number of iterations. The Congressional Budget Office analysis said it would lead to tens of millions of Americans losing health coverage. And I wonder if you could give our listeners an assessment of the most recent attempt at health reform.
Well, healthcare is very complicated, as everyone knows, and the fact that even we couldn't get agreement within one of the parties, let alone agreement cost the two major political parties, kind of attests to that. I think the fundamental issues at hand now are a basic conservative view about a minimalist involvement of government in healthcare, whether it be requiring you to have health insurance, to a more moderate view of now that over 20 million people have health insurance that hadn't had it before the Affordable Care Act, what would be the ramifications of taking those benefits away? I think the idea of just fully repealing the Affordable Care Act without a replacement is even worse than either the House or Senate alternatives, and it's going to be a big struggle, I think, for Senate Leader McConnell to make this happen.
Well, Mark, you're considered the founder of value-based insurance design. That's a pretty unique approach to structuring health insurance in a way that seeks to align health expenditures in a way that they better incent healthy behaviors for patients and also facilitate better chronic disease management among clinicians. But if you would, describe the basic tenets of value-based insurance design.
Like you, I'm practicing medicine, and I found that even my patients with insurance were having a tough time paying through co-payments and co-insurance the things I begged them to do. And I had met with my close colleague, Michael Chernu, now at Harvard Medical School, and basically said, shouldn't health insurance make it easy for the services that are deemed as quality metrics? And lo and behold, came something called the benefit-based copay. We changed the term to value-based insurance design, or VBID, which is hopefully an intuitive idea that is a new type of insurance cost-sharing model where instead of having cost sharing be high on high cost things and low on low cost things, we would have cost sharing set high for high value, those things that make you healthy, and have cost sharing be higher on those things that don't. I brought this idea to the U.S. Congress before the healthcare reform deliberations in President Obama's administration. It seemed that the idea was an intuitive one and also one that garnered bipartisan support. And we were very fortunate to have a VBID element included in the Affordable Care Act, which is one of the most popular, right. That being the removal of patient cost sharing for high-value preventive services like cancer screenings, counselings, and vaccines. We've also had significant implementation in the large self-insured employer community, and I would give them credit for kind of driving the idea regarding implementation. And now we've also seen implementation of value-based insurance design in many public programs, including state employees, as well as the Medicare Advantage value-based insurance design model test.
When you spoke in front of Congress during that passage of the Affordable Care Act there, it sparked interest in this so-called value-based care. And as you've learned in your own efforts with value-based insurance design, not easy to achieve. And I wonder if you could talk to our listeners about value-based care and how it might intersect with value-based insurance design, and how do you see these two processes intersecting?
Sure. Thanks, Mark. I think the alliterative phrase volume to value has now become de rigueur in healthcare policy discussions. But I think a major tenet of value-based insurance design is this concept of clinical nuance that we've coined, and basically making the statement that the value of a medical service differs within tiers of medical services, such as doctor visits, diagnostic tests, and drugs within the tier of the formulary. I think people would agree that some visits are more important than others, and certain drugs within the tier of the formulary are more important than others. An example might be in the specialty pharma tier, where there's a lot of focus now. Most Americans pay the same coinsurance for a targeted immunotherapy drug that will cure a disease 90% of the time as a drug that never cures a case. So the idea of different values within different categories of healthcare services has been well received. Even if you pick a high-value service, it really is determined by who receives it. So if you take colorectal cancer screening, which is an example I use all the time, a first-degree relative of a colon cancer sufferer should actually be paid to get screened. But a 35-year-old who watched Katie Couric's Today Show colonoscopy with no family history should not get covered at all. I talk about value-based payment as peanut butter and value-based insurance design as jelly. This is a classic example of the sum being greater than the individual parts. So, for instance, if I am paid for a quality metric, such as getting my diabetic patients to the eye doctor, I would hope that my patients with diabetes have generous coverage to go to the eye doctor. And unfortunately, that is not the case in a majority of diabetics in America. So we have been trying to put in place to be paid more for doing the things that make Americans healthier, and at the same time making sure that those Americans who could benefit from those services don't have to foreclose on their home to get the care they need.
Well, Mark, you noted earlier one of the biggest barriers to better outcomes could be the rising cost of out-of-pocket expenses for a million of Americans, and that's not just those on the Obamacare exchange. I think it's important to point out. You know, we talked about the preventive services, and, you know, it's been great to see the list of essential benefits with preventive services available at no deductible or copay. All of this can lead to putting off care that is, as you say, desirable and necessary. And so talk with us about the cost part of the healthcare equation that we've just had such a hard time getting a handle on.
We have more than enough money in the American healthcare system. It's just that we're spending in the wrong places. So we've been trying very hard to change the healthcare conversation from how much we spend to how well we spend it, because all the things that you two would deem as high-value services, almost all of them are underutilized. And Americans do not care about how much we're spending on healthcare in the United States. They care about what it costs them. And that's why our focus has not been on the $3.7 trillion we spend on healthcare, but focusing over 20 years on what Americans actually have to pay out of their own pockets for premiums, coinsurance, and deductibles. It's deductibles that are keeping me up at night. So as the main focus of American healthcare policy is not improving health, in my opinion, it's actually lowering healthcare costs. The main lever on the patient side that's being used is cost shifting and making us pay more at the point of care. So instead of these blunt instruments, such as in these high deductible health plans where Americans have to pay more for everything, why don't we design a smarter cost sharing system that we make Americans pay even more out of pocket for the $500 billion in services that we're buying now that don't make Americans any healthier. So we are pushing very hard for smarter co-payments and now for smarter deductibles. And I feel extraordinarily fortunate to have one of the very few healthcare reform ideas with substantial bipartisan and multi-stakeholder support.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mark Fendrick, co-creator of the concept of value-based insurance design. Dr. Fendrick is a practicing internist, a professor of medicine, and is co-founder of the director of the University of Michigan Center for Value-Based Insurance Design. He's also a founding partner of VBID Health. Mark, you launched this venture with several partners out of the sort of modern-day garage, your lab, into a more widely adopted approach, and VBID now has been quite successful, it seems. You're partnering up with TRICARE, Medicare Advantage, and others. And you've gotten support from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation for your work. And I'm wondering, what are you seeing as results as you scale up VBID?
Right. So driving force for value-based insurance design has been large private and now public employers. Most of the programs have what I call carrot VBID programs, is that they only lower cost sharing for high-value services. And as you might expect, as costs go down, there's a modest increase in the use of those services, and we often see little or no increase in aggregate expenditures as we use those services more often and health has improved. But given the pressure to lower costs, obviously there's been some momentum to add sticks. So you mentioned the CMMI, Medicare Advantage Value-Based Insurance Design Model Test, and you can imagine being primary care providers is that the burden of chronic illness is greatest in the Medicare population, and 98% of the spend is there. And where we really felt the value of VBID is in those common chronic diseases. So I had argued for over a decade that the real value of value-based insurance design is in our seniors with chronic diseases. And unfortunately, it required a waiver of the Medicare law, which had prohibited kind of this clinically nuanced or personalized medicine approach, in that fact that in the Medicare program, every single beneficiary has to have the same design. We got a demonstration approved by CMMI after we had legislation introduced in the House and Senate to support this initiative. And January 1 of this year, the program was rolled out in 9 plans in 3 of the 7 eligible states. And CMMI has already expanded the demonstration to 10 states and 2 more conditions starting this year. The most exciting thing about this is that there is bipartisan bicameral legislation to expand the CMMI VBID demo to all 50 states. The same holds true for the TRICARE program. We were very, very honored to approach VBID as a way to improve the health of those people who are serving in our armed forces, but also be fiscally responsible to try to contain healthcare costs. And our last area is in the area of health savings accounts, high deductible health plans. If people are following the healthcare reform discussion, you'll see that there is true love of health savings accounts by the Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration. Many people don't know, however, to have a health savings account, you put money in tax-free, it grows tax-free and comes out tax-free. These accounts must be coupled with an IRS-qualified high deductible health plan, which has a really blunt deductible and has been shown to kind of stop patients from using high-value essential services. So we've been working to make this change for a decade. We were very happy to see a draft executive order from the Trump administration, which applies this amendment to the IRS safe harbor guidance. Since everything in Ann Arbor is about football, we feel we're on the one-yard line and are really hopeful that we could plunge over the goal line sometime soon.
But, you know, I want to talk a little bit, Mark, about what all of us in the delivery of healthcare see, which is the challenge of getting people to do what they need to do to get healthy and stay healthy and prevent the onset of disease, because behavior change is just really hard for all of us. But all organizations are seeking new ways to incentivize wellness into the employee experience because they recognize the enormous weight of both health care costs, but also the burden of illness. So what has your research shown over the years about the best approaches to incentivizing behavior change?
While removing financial barriers will increase modestly the likelihood that one of our patients will do what we want them to do, is under no circumstances should be perceived as a panacea in terms of getting people to do what's clinically recommended. And one of the best ways we validated that was in a very large randomized trial where we provided half of the group their medications after having a heart attack to prevent their second one at no cost, compared to a really good insurance program with some co-pays. And in the standard insurance plan, these life-saving drugs were only used 38% of the time. When we made them free, it improved by 25% to the high 40s. But when you hear high 40s and drugs that have been so well established to save lives is somewhat astounding, suggesting we have a number of things that we need to do outside of removing financial barriers. Literacy programs, transportation, and there's a very explicitly mentioned part of the VBID demo that the Medicare Advantage plans can actually extend supplemental benefits that fall a bit outside the range of what we consider medical to improve quality of care. Things like transportation, if you cannot get to your appointments, it makes things very difficult. So I do want to make a brief point about employers and what you say, wellness programs. Just about everyone has heard this line that 5% Americans make up 50% of our spend. The healthiest 50% of Americans make up 3% of spend. We have focused not only the VBID programs on chronic diseases, as we've mentioned in Medicare and in commercial plans, we've also tried to target wellness programs. And a great example of that is the diabetes prevention program. I'm extraordinarily pleased to know that the diabetes prevention program is something that's included in these high-value preventive services. And those services now are fully covered by commercial plans and Medicare. And there was a new guidance put out recently from the government suggesting that we in primary care will start getting reimbursed at a higher rate if we get our patients to succeed in the DPP.
Huh, that is great. You know, one of the things that we are just about to publish, we did a randomized clinical trial with Yale and our Weizmann Institute on smoking cessation, where we paid Medicaid recipients who were smokers to quit. They were paid by engagement. So if they came in for counseling and the like, and we have to think about different models. You know, I want to shift a little and get back to what's happening into the Washington, sort of the dysfunctionality, and hopefully after all this finger pointing is over and and the president stops tweeting about letting Obamacare die, and there are people who start to think about coming to the table. And you've been one who've really tried to work both sides of the aisle. Where do you see that seam of opportunity as we think about addressing some of the flaws in the ACA and really start developing and fostering a culture of innovation so ideas such as yours can have meaningful impact on some of the important goals that you've talked about and that we're all trying to attain?
Yeah, another really tough area. So certainly I think most people agree on both sides of the aisle that in the short term, establishing the cost-sharing subsidies and reinsurance funds for the super high utilizers are critical to stabilize the markets just to keep them around. What we have discussed for many years and realized there's a bit of urgency for is to find a health plan that kind of threads the needle that provides a generous coverage that one side of the aisle would push for, but also be fiscally responsible, keeping premiums and deductibles down for those who take a more conservative pro-market approach. And I think that I've been trying to advise policymakers federally and nationally that you could have generous coverage or you could have low premiums and deductibles. You can't have both. And what we have argued is to try to use this nuanced approach moving forward. And we are working to start designing what we call VBID X. I know that's kind of a cute name, but a VBID plan that can be used on the individual marketplace, which kind of keeps that tenet of coverage for high value services, which is the theme of the ACA through the essential health benefits that Margaret mentioned, but also have increased aspects of transparency and accountability for the members. So imagine a plan that actually extends coverage to selected high-value services in a generous way, but maintains a significant deductibles on those low-value services, such as those mentioned in the Choosing Wisely campaign. And, you know, so my view is, as I said earlier, I love high deductibles if they're really limited to things that we shouldn't buy. And that's the hypothetical motivation of cost sharing in the first place. You know, I don't think that we should put cost sharing in front of a patient who has a genetic marker and has a precise treatment for their condition. But at the same time, I'm more than happy to make people pay 100% out of pocket for services for show that the evidence does not bear their use. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to find that very, very, you know, thin way to get the needle through, to thread the needle, to find a plan that satisfies us in terms of the level of coverage, but also doesn't break the bank or have premium increases, which has been, you know, so vitriolic and rhetorical in the political discourse.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Mark Fendrick, co-creator of the concept of value-based insurance design, co-founder and director of the University of Michigan Center for Value-Based Insurance Design, and founding partner of VBID Health. You can learn more about his work by going to vbidcenter.org or follow him on Twitter at @UM_VBID. Dr. Fendrick, thank you so much for the interesting and important work that you are doing and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump said that by allowing insurers to sell plans across state lines, quote, your premiums will be down 60% and 70%. We couldn't find any study supporting such a decrease, and experts we consulted disputed the idea that overall average premiums would decline significantly. Allowing insurers to sell policies across state lines has been a popular proposal among Republicans for some time. This would affect the individual market, where those without employer plans or government plans like Medicaid buy their own coverage. Proponents say this would promote competition and cut down on state insurance regulations, leading to more choice and lower prices. Trump spoke of making this policy separate legislation from a repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which set countrywide insurance standards for minimum benefits and limits on how insurers can vary pricing based on age, for instance. So if insurance companies could sell across state lines and state regulators didn't have to follow ACA requirements, would premiums on the individual market drop significantly? Joseph Antos, a healthcare expert with the American Enterprise Institute, told us that while there could be some reduction, insurers would still be locked into the cost of health services in a given geographic area. So a cheap plan in an inexpensive locale would still have to be priced higher if sold in a high-cost area. Linda Bloomberg with the Urban Institute said that some people could see a big drop if insurers significantly curtailed benefits, selling plans without much insurance protection to healthy people. But that would also drive up premiums for those wanting comprehensive insurance and in states that want to have insurance regulations. It's also unclear how much insurers want to sell plans across state lines. Aetna's CEO said this year that the idea is outdated because insurers now are aligned with networks of providers that they create in a certain area. The American Academy of Actuaries said in a brief on the issue this year that cost savings achieved through negotiating provider networks can be larger than any savings from differences in benefit requirements. But it may be difficult for insurers entering a new state market to negotiate with providers. Since this policy hasn't been tried, we don't know exactly what impact it would have, but we found no evidence for the president's claim that selling across state lines would reduce premiums by 60 and 70%. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When Leanne Brown was a graduate student in nutritional science at NYU, she came to understand the enormous challenges of eating healthy foods while doing field work with some of New York City's more impoverished populations. And when it came time to do her thesis, she thought, why not write a cookbook of health recipes aimed at the millions of Americans living on food stamps or SNAP stipends of $4 a day?
$4 a day is sort of the general rule of thumb for around how much a person who is qualifying for food stamps would have to eat per day. So we felt like that was a more useful sort of explanation. It sort of explains like a budget range. It's sort of like a way of saying, this is a SNAP cookbook without actually saying it in so many words.
She learned that while poverty was a serious issue, the lack of access to nutritious food was also contributing to obesity and poor health in many of these families. So she conducted extensive research on shopping and healthy cooking techniques and crafted Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at not only teaching these families how to shop for affordable produce and healthy foods, but how to get an entire family to cook in a more healthy way.
I really wanted to arm people with the ability to walk into a grocery store and say, like, okay, this is on sale. I can totally make something delicious out of that. I know how to do that. And, you know, that's not the easiest thing to be able to do. For a lot of people, you go, this is the recipe I have. This is my list of ingredients. I better go and carefully shop for each of those. But that doesn't allow you to sort of find the deals and find the value in order to really get by on such a small amount of money. You need to be able to be adaptable.
Her thesis was so well received, she launched a Kickstarter campaign to raise enough money to make the book available at soup kitchens, women's shelters, and community health centers. And for every copy she sells, she gives one free copy to a school, a health center, or an organization that requested.
We can't give these books away completely free, but the idea is that this is a cookbook that needs to be put into the hands of someone who really can't afford the cookbook. So that's where the idea of doing the buy one, give one, like Tom's Shoes, came from. Was sort of like, there are people out there who are really excited about this issue and have money to spend on it and who can appreciate that if they can sort of help to subsidize those who can't.
Well, a new version of her book comes out in June. She's made her book available as a free PDF download to anyone who wants it. And thousands of people have already done so.
Good and Cheap, a cookbook aimed at the food stamp population or anyone else on fixed income for that matter, teaching them how to shop for healthy produce and making that healthier choice into delicious meals, helping to positively influence their diets, obesity, and well-being. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.